Last week we started to look at the various kinds of psychic powers, which are classified as the Atta Jnana, the eight kinds of knowledge, eight kinds of higher knowledge. And we looked last week at the what's called here Vipassana Jnana, in fact the Jnana Dasana, the knowledge and vision of one's body and mind, and the Mano Maya Idhi, the ability to make a mind-made body. And I believe we looked briefly at, but didn't discuss in detail, the Idhi Vidhi. Is that right? The 10 kinds of psychic powers, is that right? We didn't look at that. Yeah. No, we looked at the 10 kinds of success, but not at the actual, that was the background to the Idhis. We didn't look at the actual psychic powers themselves. Is that right? I think that's right. Okay, that's correct. Yes, we looked at the meaning of the word Idhi, which is the normal meaning of the normal word that's used in the Indian context for a psychic power. Okay, so then we have this standard list of psychic powers, which of course always said to be emerging from based on the fourth jhana. Not everyone who gets the fourth jhana, but some people who do. Also, of course, closely associated with what we call the four Iddhipadas, or bases of psychic power. So if you want to develop the psychic power specifically, the Iddhi specifically, then you need to develop the Iddhipadas, the Chanda, Virya, Chitta, and Vimamsa. So here's a list of the, here's the basic passage, of course is repeated countless times. When his mind is thus concentrated, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady and attained to imperturbability, he directs and inclines it to the modes of supernormal power. Having been one, he becomes many. Having been many, he becomes one. He appears and vanishes. He goes unimpeded through walls, ramparts and mountains as if through space. He dives in and out of the earth as if it were water. He walks on water without sinking as if it were earth. Sitting cross-legged, he travels through space like a winged bird. With his hand, he touches and strokes the sun and the moon, so mighty and powerful. He exercises mastery over the body as far as the Brahma world. And this being, as with all of these, is supplemented by a lovely simile. Great king, suppose a skilled potter or his apprentice were to make and fashion out of well-prepared clay whatever kind of vessel he might desire. Or suppose a skilled ivory worker or his apprentice were to make and fashion out of well-prepared ivory whatever kind of ivory work he might desire. Or suppose a skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to make and fashion out of well-prepared gold whatever kind of gold work he might desire. In the same way, the bhikkhu thus wields his inclines his mind to developing these various kinds of supernormal power. And interesting that those similes are talking about some kind of artistic creation, and this kind of idea that it's through the creative forces, the intentions and the designs in your mind, that you can physically create things. And remember that this in the ancient world in mythology was very regularly taken a lot more seriously than we would. And there are just countless stories from Genesis where the man is made out of mud and then becomes living, which of course goes back to Egypt. And what's his name? Who was the potter? Ancient Egypt potter. Can't remember. That was a very well-known analogy for creating a human body. And all over the world, it's believed that statues and these kinds of things made in human form can actually come to life by various magical powers, and this has been believed right up to the present day, with the Mary in the cheese on toast sold on eBay, and various other kinds of expressions of that wonderful thing we call faith. So I'll just so this is the text, and as usual, the text is fairly straightforward, but doesn't give us a huge amount of details in terms of actually how to develop it and so on. So I'll just give a few examples and from the Visuddhimagga. Okay. So Visuddhimagga's discussion is extensive, and I won't read through all of it, but one of the important parts about developing these things is the idea of resolution. When he's accomplished these things consisting of these various roads to power and various preliminary practices, then he attains jhana as the basis for direct knowledge and emerges from it. Then if he wants to become 100, he does the preliminary work thus. So the word that's translating as preliminary work is in Pali, parikama, which is actually an important word that you should know. Parikama is pari, kama of course meaning work, and pari normally meaning all the way through, but here actually normally it means all the way through, and it's actually pari is related to the English per, as in pervade and so on, but here it seems to have more meaning of pre. I wonder whether it's etymologically related, but anyway, parikama is essentially the preparation work that you do for your meditation. In Thai they say barikam. So your barikam is, for example, your meditation word that you sit down and you recite Buddha, 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 and this is your barikam, your parikama. So you having completed your parikama, your preliminary work, you resolve, let me become 100. Let me become 100. After you attain jhana as a basis for direct knowledge, you emerge and you resolve, you become 100 simultaneously with the resolving consciousness. So you have that, so according to this, the method is that you first of all, if you want to do that, you first of all, you create that resolution very powerfully in your mind, I want to multiply my body 100 times, then you get into jhana, and then you come out of it, and then you repeat that. And then as soon as you repeat it when you come out of the jhana, then bingo, your body's been multiplied 100 times. The same method applies if you want to do it 1,000 and so on. And then if you don't succeed, you do the preliminary work again and attain, emerge and resolve a second time, and so on. Okay, so then it gives the example of the story of Chula Pantaka. So do you all know the story of Chula Pantaka? No? Some do, some don't? Well, you should do, because Mitra made a film about it a couple of years ago. So, if the guys in Mitra know about it, then you should. It's a famous... Chula Pantaka. Pantaka, not Hataka. That's a different one. Pantaka, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Pantaka means roadling. So, two brothers, the senior was called Mahapantaka, the second one called Chulapantaka. He went forth into homelessness and reached arahantship. That's his Mahapantaka did. When he'd become an arahant, he made Chulapantaka go forth too, and he gave him this verse. So this is his teaching. As a scented Kokanada lotus opens in the morning with its perfume, see the one with radiant limbs who glitters like the sun's orb blazing in the heavens. So this is his Dhamma study that he has to learn. So obviously just a very simple devotional verse. 4 months went by, but he couldn't learn it off by heart. Yeah? 4 months. And then his brother said to him, "You're useless," and threw him out of the monastery. This is a whole kind of selfish arahant story, this one. It's a bit harsh, isn't it? 4 months. At that time, the elder had charge of the allocation of meal invitations. That's Mahapantika. Jivaka approached him and saying, please invite the bhikkhus with the Buddha to our house for 500 monks for the meal. And the elder, Mahapantika, said, I accept for all except for Chulapantika. Oh, that's pretty bad, isn't it? And then Chulapantika stood weeping at the gate. Interesting, it's like Mahapajapati. The Buddha saw him with the divine eye and said to him, why are you crying? He said and was told what was happened. And the Buddha said, no one in my dispensation is called useless just because he can't recite a verse. Do not grieve, bhikkhu. Taking him by the arm, he led him into the monastery. He created a piece of cloth for him by supernormal power and gave it to him, saying, now, bhikkhu, keep rubbing this and recite over and over again, removal of dirt, removal of dirt. While doing this, he'd been told the cloth became black in colour. So he's sort of rubbing it in his hands and it gets the dirt on the hands. He came to perceive thus the cloth is clean. There's nothing wrong with it. It is this selfhood that is wrong. He brought this knowledge to bear on the five aggregates, and by increasing insight he reached the neighbourhood of conformity knowledge and change of lineage knowledge. These are technical terms in the Vipassana Jnanas. And then the Buddha then gave some verses. It is greed, not dust, that we call dirt. And dirt is just a term we use for greed. This greed the wise reject, and they abide keeping the Dhamma of him that has no greed. And the same for hate and for delusion. When the stanzas were finished, the Venerable Chulapantika had at his command the 9 supramundane states attended by the 4 discriminations and 6 kinds of direct knowledge. My goodness. Eh? So who knows what all those things are? 9 Lokottara Dhammas?
Something
of
the
ten powers
of the
Tathagata. No, it's nothing like them. Transcendent. Beyond the world.
The knowledge of
Christ's life.
No.
No. Nope.
In the Vedic Timasa, it says the Buddha, in the Buddha Gambia, fought instructed for meditation. But instructed for meditation, the Buddha gives Chula Sangha Sahas Rosa and Lady Spirit.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not in the Buddha, it's not in the
exactly, yeah.
And the Buddha acted constantly, he never had any formula for everybody. For one person, he has a different way for that person to practice.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. So the 9 Lokottara Dhammas: path and fruit of stream entry, path and fruit of once return, path and fruit of non-return, path and fruit of arahantship, and nibbana is number 9. 9 Lokottara Dhammas. That's right. And the 4 Patisambhidas, 4 discriminations, what are they? They're translated as discriminations, but the Pali word Patisambhida. No? No? It's very, it might be verbally understood, but the list is standard. Yeah.
Is one of them saying the beautiful in the
ugly? Nope. That's the Arya Idhi, which we talked about yesterday. And this is the Patisambhidas.
Is it from the suttas or from the Visuddhimagga terminology?
From the suttas. Not much, no.
In the
Patisambhidamagga, yeah. It lists them in the suttas. There might be a little bit about them, but I think that they're also there, the meaning is clear enough. Sorry? Trustworthy. Well, a bit hard to say. I mean, it's they're mentioned only a few times in the suttas, not very often, and could be a later development, but certainly something which was emphasized very greatly in the Theravadin school, much more so than the other schools. So the four Patisambhidas, sometimes these two are in a different order. And what it means here, Dhamma here means text. Atta means meaning. So in a sense, text and commentary. The term commentary is always called the Attakatha. Niruti is language. Niruti, what it implies, or what it suggests, is that somebody who has these four Patisambhidas would have an intuitive knowledge of the right way to use language in their phrasing of Dhamma. So that they would know what is an accurate way of saying things and what is not, and so on. It's explained in the Visuddhimagga explains it as saying that somebody who has this Niruti Patisambhida would know immediately that, for example, that is wrong. Yeah? Even if you've never studied Pali grammar, yeah, then you'd know that it actually should be paso and vedana. Okay? But even if you've never studied and don't know anything about Pali, you would intuitively know that's wrong. This is the way it's interpreted. I think it's a little bit over the top, but basically the idea is that you have an intuitive grasp of the nature and uses of language and how the Dhamma can be expressed most effectively using language. Yeah, presumably the language that you're using, yeah, presumably. I mean, Niruti actually often means dialect. And so when it's discussed in the suttas, one of the things it says is, for example, it says, you know, if you go to different regions, then they'll use the same word, different words for the same thing. And then it gives a whole list of different synonyms for the word bowl, yeah. And so it's that kind of skill in language, understanding what people are using, you know, maybe the same word in different ways or using different words to refer to the same thing. And so the ability to discern that and not to get confused. How to use it, yeah. Yep. Yep, yeah. He does, yeah. Yep. Dhamma. It's in different ways in different places, yeah. Often it's atta first, yeah. 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 No, that's what Niruti means. Dhamma means knowing the text. Exactly, yeah.
And then Niruti is always using correct language.
Yeah, yeah. It is, and as you say, it's closely connected with the idea of giving Dhamma talks, and as a set, it's found most prominently in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is actually of all the Nikayas the most concerned with teaching Dhamma. So yes, it's closely connected with that. Patibhana means. Paribhana is the quality by which a poet will spontaneously create inspired verses in the moment. Yeah? So it's improvisational inspiration. In other words, it's the ability of someone who's speaking to articulate in the moment, to basically improvise the Dhamma talk. Yeah? So it's the idea that you can marshal all of these other qualities. Your knowledge of the texts, what the actual teachings are, your knowledge of what the meanings, the implications, the connections between those teachings are, your use of language to be able to phrase those things. And Patibbana means that you can put all that together in the moment to create a coherent and articulate teaching. Yes, yeah, synthesis, to be able to synthesize it, yeah.
Like when I was on ground, they ask him sometimes five questions, and they're slightly different. And he kind of answers them all in the same talk, and it's so smooth. So he's all the questions into one answer.
Yeah. That's Patibbana, yeah. But basically the ability to give a spontaneous Dhamma talk is Patibbana. Exactly, yeah. And that's why it's specifically mentioned in this context.
This example, is basically a something could do. So how could he get scripture knowledge of the commentaries and stuff?
I think you could, because when you hear stuff, stuff is there, but often the problem with memory is your ability to recall it. So if you've got some blockage on your recalling ability, and if that's removed, then I don't see why not. Three Pitikas. So,
this story is only in the
commentaries? In the commentaries, yeah.
And it's actually
higher described in the sutras. We mentioned earlier that.
But you mentioned so many things so quickly, I can't
afford to. It's found in the sutras in a number of places, most prominently in the Anguttara Nikaya, but it's never explained particularly in detail in the suttas. But the meaning, but the, as far as I'm concerned, the meaning of the terms is clear enough from the context.
And in what context
are they describing it? Yeah, typically the ones who have them are the ones who you'd expect to have them. People like, I think, Mahakotita or Mahakachayana, monks who give very kind of detailed and analytical expositions of Dhamma. Yeah. In the Pali tradition, the Patisambhidas are closely associated. See, they're hardly known outside the Pali tradition. They're one of these teachings which occurs a couple of times in the early texts and which most of the later schools kind of passed over. But in the Pali tradition, for one reason or another, actually the Mahavihara tradition as such, which is where we get the Pali text from, defined itself as a textual tradition right from the beginning. And their pride was in their own excellence in maintaining a pristine copy of the text, which was perfectly edited and so on. So they emphasized this right through their tradition.
I think that's sort of nice, because they have their original text they maintained in a very pure way.
Yeah.
And then if they put a lot of value to others, there's only people with these ability.
Patisambhida. Yeah.
The sort of people who give very, very inspiring Dhamma talks and interpret the text according to particular circumstances and questions and the needs of particular people.
Yeah.
That sort of, it seems to me, it's a bit the same as in the same Mahayana tradition where sutras from an inspired teacher, it actually got written down.
Right.
And maybe then it became worthy. Maybe then the inspired teachers gave inspiring talks, and then they were forgotten, and then the next inspired
So the original, so the pure, like Pitika, is still the basis. So nobody was tempted to actually replace that with, so they didn't write down the new style and
They did write them down. That's what we've got here. This is the cornerstone of the commentaries, which are very large, yeah. That's right, yeah. Interesting thing about them is that in Ajahn Mun's biography, before he became an arahant, he said that he had a vision that he would not realize these four Parisamvidas. Hmm.
Who is the kind of founding monk of the Mahavira? I mean, kind of the
Mahinda?
I mean, who's the idea of the disciple?
Well, Mahinda.
Yeah. Some group of monks in Mahakasapa,
yeah.
They all said they live in the forest. So that kind of line is they all meditate, they don't have books.
Yeah.
So who's the one for Mahakasapa? Maybe that's why they developed these into a whole system.
Yeah. I mean, it could be. I mean, actually, now that you mention that, it's actually an interesting suggestion because Kachayana lived in Avanti, I think it was Avanti, and he was the one who was in the southwest, and he's associated with the Padisambhidas, and Avanti is where Mahinda came from. Yeah, and it's where Mahinda and his friends stayed on their way from Pataliputta down to Sri Lanka. As you go from Pataliputta, you go. Where are we? So from Pataliputta up here, they would depart to Sri Lanka from Andhra, but you don't go down that way. You go, the Dakinapata goes this way. I guess there's mountains and things in here. So you go down here to Avanti, and then down to the Dakinapata. Southern road, and then you go from Andhra down to Sri Lanka. So Mahinda, his family, I think his mother came from the Avanti region or something like that. He had family connections there, and so he left from Pataliputra, stayed there for a while, and then come down. But that's where I think it was Mahakachayana stayed. Unknown. Mora Kanda Chetty or something like that. No one knows. There's all legends about it, but none of them know. Yeah, in Shakyamuni Siddhi Magas. Yeah, it's fantastic. But he just, in his own words, he just described himself once as saying he's of this town, of Mora Kanda Chetty. Moranda Chetika, but even that doesn't really mean. For Moranda Chetika, we don't know where it is, for a start, and secondly, we don't even know what it actually means. Does that mean the place that he was living in at the time, or the place where he was born, or the place where his ordination monastery was, or we really don't know?
Did he also come to Sri Lanka from Andhra?
Ah. quite possible. I mean, he's generally regarded as being an Indian, and the Mahavihara had a monastery in Andhra, so it's entirely possible. But they also had a monastery in Bodh Gaya, so who knows?
And he knew another language. When he came to Sri Lanka, he can converse with the king of Sri Lanka without a translator. It means they have the same language.
Right.
And the best were named Murai in that language until the Buddha was actually not translated out of the Pali.
Yeah.
So Ajahn language is not the Pali. It's some other power of the language.
Yep. Lukutra, Lukutra Dhamma. Lukutra Dhammas. Yeah.
And they only, like, half the stream of his
energy. Yep. Nine Lukutra Dhammas. Very good.
What's the difference between Nibbana and the fruit of arahantship? And even fruit of stream entry should be Nibbana.
That's one for the Dhamma experts there. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, maybe. Okay, so we've got the four discriminations and the six kinds of direct knowledge. The six kinds of direct knowledge, which of course the six abhinyas, which is what we're studying at the moment. So, Jula Pantika got all of these things. From cleaning a rag which got dirty. Then on the following day the Buddha went to Jivaka's house together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus. When the gruel was being given out at the end of the water offering ceremony, the Buddha covered his bowl. Jivaka said, "What is it, Bhante?" And then the Buddha said, "There's a bhikkhu at the monastery." Jivaka sent a man saying, "Go and get him and return quickly with the venerable." And the Blessed One had left the monastery. Then Chula Pantika multiplied himself 1,000 times and sat in the pleasant mango wood, waiting for the time to be announced. Now that and some of this story is actually found in Chula Pantika's Theragata verses. When the man came and saw the monastery all glowing with yellow robes, he returned and said, "Bhante, the monastery is full of bhikkhus. I don't know which one of them we should invite." And the Blessed One said, "Go and catch hold of the hem of the robe, the first one you see. Tell him, the master calls you, and bring him here." So he did that, all the creations vanished. And then he went and washed his mouth and prepared himself and then went to the seat. So this is the thing, and so that is the description here. It says, "The many who created there were just like the possessor of the supernormal power because they were created without particular specification. Then whatever the possessor of the supernormal powers does, whether he stands, sits, or speaks, or keeps silent, etc., they do the same. But if he wants to make them different," so that was the case in Chula Pantika. He did a cheap knockoff copy, right? Just like a, you know, no particular quality there. "But if he wants to make them different in appearance, some in the first phase of life, some in the middle phase, some in the last phase of life, some long-haired, some half-shaven, some shaved, some grey-haired, some with lightly dyed robes, some with heavily dyed robes, or expounding phrases, explaining Dhamma, chanting, asking questions, answering questions, cooking, dye, sewing and washing robes, etc. Or if he wants to make still others of different kinds, he emerges from the basic jhana, does the preliminary work, parikama, in the way beginning, let there be so many bhikkhus in the first phase of life, and so on and so forth. Then he should once more attain jhana, emerge, and then resolve, and then they become of the kinds desired simultaneously with the resolving consciousness. Okay. That's the end of that one. Are you kidding? Why you wouldn't want to create a copy of yourself to go off and do all the teaching and do all the work and stuff like that? It'd be great. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's why they. Why do you think they made Mahamoggallana the director of building work in the time of the Buddha? No, it's probably not essential for becoming Nibbana. That's yeah, that is a critical question. Okay. Sorry?
I'm wondering if someone wants to attain Nirvana, and let's say they attain the eight jhanas, but they think, oh, maybe I don't have enough concentration. So he wants more concentration.
Yeah.
Could he then get more concentration by developing the psychic powers just for more concentration, not necessarily for them, but kind of an extra practice?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So you develop like a skill or fluency, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the next one. He appears and vanishes. The meaning here is that he causes appearance and causes vanishing. Now this possessor of supernormal power who wants to make an appearance makes darkness into light or makes reveal what is hidden, or he makes what has not come into the visual field come into the visual field. How? If he wants to make himself or another visible, even though hidden or at a distance, he emerges from the basic jhana and adverts thus, let that is dark become light, or let this that is hidden be revealed. Then he does the parikama, the preliminary work, and resolves in the way already described, and it becomes as resolved simultaneously with the resolves. But by whom was this miracle formally performed? By the Buddha. For when the Buddha had been invited by Chula Subhadra and was traversing the 7-league journey between Savatthi and Saketa with 500 palanquins created by Visakarma, the building contractor of the gods, he resolved in such wise that the citizens of Saketa saw the inhabitants of Savatthi, and the citizens of Savatthi saw the inhabitants of Saketa. Savatthi and Saketa being not too distant. Savatthi being up here, and Saketa is not noted on this map, but Saketa is actually just down about here, just a little bit, maybe 100 k's or so. Anyway, far enough that you can't normally see one from the other. And then, when he had alighted in the center of the city, he split the earth in two and showed Avicii hell, and parted the sky in two and showed the Brahma world. Right? And this meaning should also be explained by means of the descent of the gods, Devo Rohana. And this is a very, very famous episode, which is widely represented in Buddhist stories and especially temple architecture. You see in many places you have this kind of a descending staircase with nagas on the sides, and this is like an architectural representation of the scene of the descent of the gods, which happened, according to tradition, happened at, is it Prayaga? It's here. What's the name of it? The traditional name of the place is, traditional name of the place is, I don't know. Sankacha? Sankacha in India. And there's a huge problem with that place. It's supposed to be the place where the Buddha descended from the heavens, and there's a huge stupa there. The problem is that on the top of the huge stupa there's a little Hindu shrine. So the Hindus and the Buddhists are fighting about it. And of course it's the traditional Buddhist sacred site. The problem is that the Hindu shrine was actually mentioned by Xuanzang in the 7th century. Right? So even though you say the Hindu edition is a later edition, well, yeah, it's late, but it's, you know, it's been there for 1300 years. So, yeah. But that's actually one of the biggest stupas in India that hasn't been properly excavated. Quite likely. So when the Blessed One, it seems, had performed the twin miracle, and the twin miracle is a particular kind of display of psychic powers first mentioned in the Patisambhita Magga, again became a major part of the Buddhist thing. Basically, he emits simultaneously water and fire, being the twin miracle. He had liberated 84,000 beings from bonds. He wondered, where did the past Buddhas go? When they finished the twin miracle, he saw that they'd gone to the heaven of the 33. He stood with one foot on the surface of the earth and placed the second on Mount Yugandhara. Then he lifted up his first foot and set it down at the summit of Mount Sineru. He took up residence for the rains there on the red marble terrace and began his exposition of the Abhidhamma, starting from the beginning to the deities of 10,000 world spheres. At the time for wandering for alms, he created an artificial Buddha to teach the Dhamma. Meanwhile, the Blessed One himself would chew a toothstick of Nagalata wood and wash his mouth in Lake Anuttata. Then, after collecting alms food among the Uttarakurus, this is up in Siberia or something, he would eat it at the shores of the lake. Each day the Venerable Sariputta went there, paid homage to the Buddha, who told him, "Today I taught this much Dhamma," and he gave him the method, the Naya. So the Buddha himself was teaching all the details of the Abhidhamma in the Tathagatamsa heaven, while Sariputta was the method, the scheme, the framework on which the teaching was based. And Sariputta, of course, because of his wisdom, could understand all the details when he was just given the Naya, the method. In this way, he gave an uninterrupted exposition of the Abhidhamma for 3 months, and 80 million devas penetrated the Dhamma upon hearing it. So, anyway, that goes on for quite some time. I won't read the whole story, but you can read it. Then there's this descent, and there's two flights of stairs made of crystal and all these various kinds of things. And so this is in any way an example where the Buddha multiplied himself so he could... he multiplied himself, but he also revealed things that were hidden and so on. Okay, so leaving that one, I won't read the whole story of that one, but another example that it gives here is of another monk called Dhammadina, who's a Sri Lankan monk, a resident of Talangara, who was sitting on the shrine terrace in the great monastery of Dissa, expounding the Panaka Sutta. And when he turned his fan, Dhamma fan they use for teaching and stuff, face downwards, and an opening right down to Avicii Hell appeared. Then he turned it face upwards, and an opening right up to the Brahma world appeared. Having thus aroused fear of hell and longing for the bliss of heaven, the elder taught the Dhamma. Some became stream enterers, some once returners, some non-returners, and some arahants. And it gives another example. Of course, the canonical example is Yasa, who the Buddha made disappear when he was sitting beside him when his father came to drag him back to the house. And it gives a number of others examples. Which story? Of Yasa? That's in the Kandikas, after teaching the Dhammacakka. He's still in Benares, hasn't left Benares yet. That's right, it's a very common name, yeah. Okay, so then the next one. He goes unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains, as though in open space. Okay, through walls, beyond walls, beyond defined walls, the wall, blah, blah, blah. Then the one who wants to go in this way should attain the preliminary, should attain the space kasina. Okay, so you attain the jhana based on space kasina. And emerge, and then do the preliminary work by adverting to the wall or the enclosure or some such mountain as Sineru or the World Sphere Mountain, for example, and then you resolve, let there be space. It becomes space, it becomes hollow for him if he wants to go down or up, and he goes through it unhindered. Okay, so this is the explanation given in the commentary. But here, the elder Tipitaka Chula Abhaya. And this elder Tipitaka Chula Abhaya seems to be a bit of a controversial character. He crops up once or twice in the Suddhimagga. He said, friends, why do you attain the space kasina? Because you want to make it space. He says, well, look, if you want to make an elephant, do you attain the elephant kasina? If you want to make a horse, do you attain the horse kasina? Surely. The only standard is mastery on the eight attainments, and after the preliminary work has been done on any kasina, it then becomes whatever he wishes. And then the monks in response to that said, Venerable Sir, only the space kasina has been given in the text, so it should certainly be mentioned. The text here, of course, being the Patisambhita Magga, and it gives the quotes the actual text there. Okay, so the only problem with that one is it lists the problem that the only kinds of mountains that you can't go through are the kinds that were created previously by other bhikkhus who had more psychic powers than you did. So yeah, it could, yeah. Yeah, well, you just have to try it and see, I guess, yeah. So, okay, he dives into and out of the ground, and you do this with the water kasina. You resolve, let the earth in such and such an area be water, and then it becomes water for him. Blah, blah, blah. And then not only diving in and out, but whatever he wants to use water for, bathing or drinking or so on, or if he wants to get other kinds of liquid like ghee, honey or molasses and so on, then he does so. Then it's only for him that the earth becomes water and not for anyone else. People go on it on foot and in vehicles, etc., and they do their ploughing, etc. there. But if he wishes, let it be water for them too, it becomes water for them too. Okay? On unbroken water, so this is water that one sinks into when trodden is called broken, the opposite is unbroken. So if you want to walk on water, so to do the whole Jesus thing, then you should go in this, you should attain the earth kasina and emerge, and then you resolve that this amount of water become earth, and then it becomes earth. And there is actually a serious case to be made that Jesus' walking on water miracle was actually derived from the first chapter of the Vinaya Mahavagga. and the similarities between the actual events described and also the narrative, the place within the entire story as a whole, even the words that are used, is very strong. It was one of those, I can't remember the exact things, but it was one of the, around the turn of the century, there was quite a number of scholarly attempts to show that there were similarities between the Gospels and the Buddhist texts. And a couple of them were pursued in some detail. Of course, that kind of went out of fashion, and a lot of it wasn't that persuasive. And of course, in recent years, you had more of these kind of pop culture and Jesus went to India kind of things, which were kind of discredited the whole enterprise, really. But that particular one was one of the ones that I found to be quite persuasive. There were a couple of others, like the loaves and fishes, and the old woman's two coins, which also seemed to likely derive from Buddhist sources. Well, yeah, I mean, again, there's a problem of dating Indian texts, but I mean, a lot of those stories were very widespread. For example, the story of the Buddha walking on water happens in the first chapter of the Khandakas, which became the template for all of the Buddha biographies. So it's an extremely widespread idea, and it's found in a lot of, you know, both in the canonical vignettes, which presumably date from, you know, the story would probably date from the latest, the Second Council, you know, put into the biographies and things, which became widespread following Ashoka. So I mean, we know that there is this kind of contact. We certainly know that there's contact between India and Greece at the very latest from the time of Chandragupta, who was Ashoka's grandfather. Yeah, the Greeks had an ambassador in Chandragupta's court. So we know that there was contact there. So there's no particular reason why there shouldn't be, you know, the story shouldn't spread. It's difficult to date things specifically, yeah, with these stories. But some of those stories are so widespread that you have to assume that they date from quite an early time. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's an act of God. It's like as miracles are generally presented in that tradition, it's just the whole point of it is that there isn't a context. It's supernatural. Yeah, it appears outside of the law of cause and effect. Yeah. So, I think that argument was a very persuasive one. Yeah. I mean, the details that were similar were things like in the Jesus walking on water story. There's no miracles on walking on water previously in the Western tradition, or the Hebrew tradition. The word that's used for the way that the walking is described is similar. The words that they use when they're greeted, because they're both times they're approached by people on boats and during the storm, and the words they both say, "It is I," when they're greeted. And at both times it appears in basically the same pivotal point in the conversion narrative, which is the first time that you're having large numbers of followers. When in the Mahavagga story, it's when he converts the 1,000 fire ascetics. So it's the first time he's had a large group of following. And it's the same in the gospel narrative. It's the kind of pivotal point where Jesus starts to accumulate his followers.
Who did the analysis?
Sorry?
Who did the analysis for the
person? I can't remember. Yeah. it was first done by a European scholar around 100 years ago. I can't remember his name. No, it wasn't his sense. So as well as making things earth, you can also make it gold and so on and so forth, which I think we read the story some time ago of a monk who made a golden necklace for the young girl who was, and then she got suspected of stealing it. Okay, so then next one, seated, cross-legged, he travels like a winged bird and flies through the sky. Of course, this being, as I just pointed out, this being another classic thing that the rishis in India do, is go flying around the time, all the place. And so, if you want to go cross-legged, you should do the preliminary work and then determine an area the size of a seat for sitting cross-legged on, and you should resolve in the way already described. If you want to go lying down, you determine an area the size of a bed. So this is for the more casual kind of monk. If you want to go on foot, you resolve the area the size of the path, and you say, let it be earth. Okay, and a bhikkhu who wants to travel in space should also be has someone who possesses the divine eye. Why? Because on the way there might be mountains and trees, etc., that are temperature originated, whatever that means, or jealous nagas and supanas, etc., might create them. He may be able to see them, for obvious reasons. For what should we do? And then he attains the basic jhana, emerges, does the preliminary work, and resolves. But the elder Tipitaka Chula Abhaya, again, I like this guy, I would have got on well with him, said, friends, what is the use of attaining this attainment? Is not his mind concentrated? Since any area that he's resolved thus, let there be space, is space. Though he spoke Thus, nevertheless, the matter should be treated as described under the miracle of going unhindered through walls. Moreover, he should be an obtainer of the divine eye for the purpose of descending in a secluded place. For if he descends in a public place, in a bathing place or a village gate, he is exposed to the multitude, right? In other words, you've got to be able to check out where you're going to land, otherwise you could get into trouble. So that's good. And so again, Tipitaka Chula Abhaya gets dismissed again for his heretical views. But the good thing about the commentaries is that they mention these heretical views, you know, they might not accept them, but they record them, yeah? And so this is the meaning of the word we translate as commentary, but actually the meaning in Pali, attakata, literally means discussion of the meaning. Yeah? And so it's a record of the discussions of the meaning. We need to breathe in space. I don't know. Yeah, look, probably just means the sky, probably not clearly distinguished, I would imagine. Yeah. I mean, if you don't know about outer space, then the air just keeps on going up, doesn't it? Okay, then, with his hand he touches and strokes the moon and sun, so mighty and powerful. Here, the might of the moon and sun should be understood to consist in the fact that they travel at an altitude of 42,000 leagues, and their power to consist in their simultaneous illuminating of three of the four continents. And so he touches, he seizes or touches in one place, he strokes all over as though it was the surface of a looking glass. So if he wants to go and touch them, he goes and touches them. But if he wants to touch them here, sitting or lying down, he resolves, let them be within hand's reach. Then he either touches them as they stand within hand's reach, when they've come by the power of the resolve, like palm fruits loosed from their stalk, or he does so by enlarging his hand. So you've got a variety of methods there. But obviously it shows a somewhat different understanding of what the moon and sun were, especially the sun, than we're used to today. So then there's the story of Moggallana and Nandopananda, the royal Naga. Have we had that story before? Nandopananda. It's a classic one. It's a very well known story. It's in the chant, the Jayamangala Gatha. Nandopananda Bhujigang Vibhudang Mahiddin Damanapayanto, and so on. Okay, here's the story. Nandopananda, interesting enough, here is a royal Naga. But in the northern scriptures, especially in the Mulasaravasti Vardhan scriptures, Nandopananda is actually an exclamation. And it basically means crikey, okay? So something amazing happens, you go, Nandopananda! It's what the group of six monks say when they go to Vaisali and they see how beautiful it is and how it's decorated and how everything's so wonderful and, you know, it's full of all these sensual delights and everything, and they're just wandering around going, Nandopananda! Okay. So Anatta Pindika invited the Buddha with the Sangha to his house for dana. And then the Buddha reviewed in the morning, he reviewed the 10,000 fold world system, and he saw the royal Naga serpent called Nandopananda. And he thought, does he have the potential for development? And then he saw that he had wrong view and no faith in the triple gem. He considered who is there that can cure him of his wrong view. He saw that the elder Mahamoggallana could. I think we have had this story before, have we? We need to hear it again, do we? Okay. Then he saw, okay, and Mahamoggallana can cure him. Then, when the night had turned to dawn, after he'd seen to the needs of the body, he addressed Ananda told the 500 bhikkhus that the Buddha is going to visit the gods. It was on that day that they got a banqueting place ready for Nandopananda. He was sitting on a divine couch with a divine white parasol held aloft, surrounded by three kinds of dancers and a retinue of nagas, and served the various kinds of food and drink in divine vessels. Blessed One so acted that the royal naga saw him as he proceeded directly above his canopy in the direction of the 33 gods, accompanied by the 500 bhikkhus, right? So the Buddha and the 500 bhikkhus flying up to the 33. Then this evil view arose in Nandopananda, the royal naga. There go these bald-headed monks in and out of the realm of the 33 directly over my head. I will not have them scattering the dirt off their feet on our heads. His heads is plural here, presumably he's got seven heads or something. He got up and went to the foot of Cinero, changing his form. He surrounded it seven times with his coils. And of course, this being the symbol of the Kundalini, is the snake that coils seven times around the seven chakras, and the Mount Cinero being always the like the axis or the backbone of the cosmos. Changing his blah blah blah. Then he spread his hood over the realm of the 33 and made everything there invisible. Venerable Ratthapala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, standing in this place formerly, I used to see Mount Cinero and the ramparts of Cinero and the 33 and the Vajrayanta Palace and the flag over the Vajrayanta Palace. Why can't I see them now?" The Buddha said, "Ratthapala, Nandopananda is very angry with us." Ratthapala said, "I will tame him, Venerable Sir." The Buddha wouldn't allow it. Venerable Bhadya and Rahula and all the bhikkhus in turn offered to do so, but the Blessed One would not allow it. Last of all, Venerable Mahamoggallana said, "I will tame him, Venerable Sir." The Blessed One said, "Tame him, Moggallana." And then the Moggallana abandoned that form and assumed the form of a huge royal naga, and he surrounded Nandopananda 14 times with his coils and raised his hood above the other's hood, and he squeezed him against Mount Cinero. The royal naga produced smoke, and so Moggallana produced smoke. The naga smoke did not distress Moggallana, but Moggallana's smoke distressed Nandopananda. Then Nandopananda produced flames, and so did Moggallana. Then Nandopananda thought, "Who is this?" and asked him, "Who are you?" He said, "I am Moggallana." "Venerable Sir, resume your proper bhikkhu's state." The bhikkhu abandoned the form of the naga, and he went into Nandopananda's right ear and came out his left ear. He went into his left ear and came out his right ear. He went into the right nostril and came out of the left nostril, went into the left nostril and came out of the right nostril. Then Nandopananda opened his mouth. The elder went inside it and walked up and down, east and west, inside his belly. So, of course, it's being reminiscent of the classic mytheme of the being swallowed in the belly of the beast. And the Blessed One said, "Moggallana, Moggallana, beware. This is a mighty naga." Moggallana said, "Venerable Sir, the four roads to power have been developed by me, repeatedly developed, established, consolidated, properly undertaken. I can tame not only Nandopananda, Venerable Sir, but 100,000 or 100,000 royal nagas like Nandopananda." Nandopananda thought, "I didn't see him when he went in, but when he comes out of my belly, I'll catch him between my fangs and chew him up." And then he said, "Venerable Sir, come out. Don't keep troubling me by walking up and down inside my belly." The elder came out and stood outside. The royal naga recognized him and blew a blast of flame from his nose. The elder attained fourth jhana, and the blast failed to move even a single hair on his body. It seems that the other bhikkhus would have been able to perform all the miracles up to now, but at this point they could not have attained fourth jhana so rapidly, which is why the Blessed One would not allow them to tame the royal naga. Nandopananda thought, "I have been unable to move even a single hair on this monk's body with the blast from my nose. He is a mighty monk." The elder abandoned that form, and having assumed the form of Supanna, he pursued the royal naga. The Supanna, of course, or the Garuda, being the heavenly bird, which is always the enemy of the naga. pursues the royal naga, demonstrating the Supanas blast. The royal naga abandoned that form and assumed the form of a young Brahman. He said, "Venerable sir, I go to refuge to you." And Moggallana took him to the Buddha, and he went to refuge to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "May you be happy, O Naga." Then they went to Dana. Anathapindika said, "Bhante, why are you late?" It's these details that really make it. There was a battle between Moggallana and Nandopananda. Who won? Who was defeated? Moggallana won. Nanda was defeated. Anathapindika said, "Venerable sir, let the Blessed One consent to my providing meals for 7 days. Am I honoring the elder for 7 days?" So then it gets back to the touching the moon and sun. It says, if you don't, you just want to touch them, you can make a footstool of them. You can put your feet on them and make a chair of them and sit down on them. You can make a bed on them and lie on them, or lean against them. Okay. Where does it originally occur? I'm not sure. It's actually put in here as part of another one of these side discussions. It's not really directly relevant, but look, it's a commentarial story. I'm not sure where the earliest form of it comes in. Yeah. It's in the Jayamangalagatha. But that chant is a late Sinhalese compilation, Sinhalese composition. Well, quite frequently, yeah, Jayamangalagatha, yeah, it's very famous. Yeah. Sri Lankan weddings, they chant it. Yeah. Most of the other stories in that are all canonical. I think that's the only non-canonical one. Well, yeah, I mean, it's meant to be entertaining, there's no doubt about that, you know. So, you know, it's meant to be a bit of entertainment and stuff like that. Yeah, it's this kind of macho kind of thing. I mean, it's, you know, in a way, it's in a kind of a literary tradition. It relates to the, I mean, you have a very common theme of the contest, you know. So you have like the bride contest and so on, and the different myths and things like that, and you know, archery contests and all of these kinds of things. So this is like a sort of spiritualized version of that same thing. Yeah, you know, it's a storytelling trope. What, to be sitting inside a naga's mouth when it breathes fire and enter into fourth jhana so fast that you don't move a hair of your head? Well, probably beyond the power of most people, I would think, yeah. Well, perhaps it's difficult but possible. Yeah. I don't think by any means that saying jhana is easy. Yeah. Okay, so blah blah. And then interesting little comment at the end here in the Visuddhimagga. It says, even when several hundred thousand bhikkhus do this and each one succeeds, still the motions of the moon and the sun and their radiance remain the same. For just as when 1,000 sources are full of water and moon disks are seen in all the sources, still the moon's motion is normal and so is its radiance. And this miracle resembles that. So this is kind of interesting the way that it's playing with the subjectivity of the idea, whether you're actually bringing the moon and sun down here, but it's clearly it's a perceptual thing. It's like a reflection in a glass of, in a dish of water. Okay, so then the next one, he wields bodily power even as far as the Brahma world. And here, the Visuddhimagga quotes at length from the Visuddhimagga quotes at length from the Parisambhidamagga, and then gives some commentary on it. So you can go to the Brahma world in a number of different ways. So, for example, you can advert to a far-off divine world or Brahma world and say, "Let it be near," and then it becomes near. So that's one way. And it gives a number of examples. Such as when the monks were in Sri Lanka, Chula Samudra, when there was a famine in Sri Lanka and then none of the monks could get anything to eat, and he used his psychic powers and saw that in Pataliputta that there was good alms to be got that morning. So the monks walked a few steps and he abridged the earth and went to Pataliputta. And the monks were confused. They didn't know where they were. He said, "Where are we?" They said, "This is Pataliputta." He said, "But that's so far away." He said, "Friends, experienced monks make what is far near." "But what about the ocean? Didn't we cross the ocean?" He said, "Friends, didn't you see a blue stream on the way as you came?" He said, "Yes, venerable sir, but the ocean is vast." "Friends, experienced monks also make what is vast small." So they popped up from arms from here to here. Bingo. Got something to eat? Thank you. Okay. So I'm not sure how many of these examples I should read out. So... So it says here that you can so it says in the Parisambhidamagga, it says, if this possessor of supernormal power wants to go to the Brahma world with a visible body, he converts his mind to accord with his body. Having converted his mind to accord with his body, he arrives at a blissful perception and perception of bliss and perception of light. And he goes to the Brahma world with a visible body. If he wants to go to the Brahma world with an invisible body, He converts his body to accord with his mind, and he arrives at a perception of bliss and perception of light, and goes to the Brahma world with an invisible body. He creates a fine material visible form before that of Brahma, mind made with all its limbs lacking no faculties, is similar to the mind made body we looked at earlier. If that possessor of supernormal power walks up and down, the creation walks up and down, and so on. So this is how it describes that. So the perception of bliss and perception of light, Visuddhimagga goes on to comment on this and says that these are conascent with the consciousness whose object is the basic jhana. And it is perception associated with equanimity that is called perception of bliss, for equanimity is called bliss since it is peaceful. That's an interesting explanation. And the same perception should be understood as perception of lightness too, because it's liberated from hindrances and from the things that oppose it, beginning with vitaka. But he arrives at that state, his physical body too becomes as light as a tuft of cotton. Oh, sorry, so this should be perception of lightness, not perception of light. Okay, so he goes to the Brahma world thus with a visible body's light as a tuft of cotton wafted by the wind. So if he wishes, he creates a path in space by means of the earth casino and goes on foot. If he wishes, he resolves by means of the air casino that there shall be air, and he goes by air like a tuft of cotton. And so on. Yeah. He converts his body to accord with his mind. He takes the body and mounts it on the mind. He makes its going swift to coincide with that of the mind, for the mind's mode of going is swift. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that you go as literally as swift as thought. So you just think about it, and you've mounted your body on the mind, like your mind is a chariot, and the swiftness of your mind takes you there. Okay, so that's about it for the various kind of iddhi vidhas. So we go endlessly. There are endless stories here in the Visuddhimagga and in the traditions about these iddhis. And as we pointed out before, that they're not probably, they're probably something which is included more to accord with the traditional notions of what you're supposed to get out of spiritual practice. Quite likely they're actually there because monks get excited by these kinds of things, and it gives you something interesting to talk about, because the Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination are a little bit boring. As I pointed out, they're not really kind of heavily featured in any of the suttas or anything like that. There's a few mentions of some kinds of psychic powers, which don't necessarily correspond with this classic list exactly, but certainly there's a massive tendency in all the later traditions to exaggerate the importance of these things. Well, maybe, but the monks are a lot, yeah. I don't know, are nuns excited by these things? Monks are. Yeah. Psychic powers and stuff, yeah. 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 That's right, yeah. Okay, so then we might have just time for today for the divine ear element. And of course, interesting that in the Pali words we have dibba sota for the divine ear, and dibba chakku, Dibba we're translating as divine, and obviously from the same root as the English word divine. Yeah. Divine ear. And Chibachaku, divine eye. So the root dib and div are from the same Indo-European root, but the meaning of dibachaku is actually from originally from the old Indo-European root, which I think is something like that. In the oldest sort of reconstructed Indo-European form, and the original oldest meaning of it is basically the day. Yeah, so it's the light of day. It's the clarity of the skies and the heavens is what's being talked about. So the root meaning is the clarity or brightness of daytime, and literally the English word day. And so the actual, even though in Buddhism, sort of Buddhist hybrid English, we translate as divine ear. Actually, the normal English word is actually clairaudience, and for divine eye is clairvoyance. Voyance. Is that how you spell clairvoyance? Something like that. Which actually is literally correct, because the root clair is clear, which is actually the meaning here. It means both divine, but actually more importantly means clear. Yeah, so it's like it's the clarified and purified hearing and the purified seeing. And one of the important points about these particular psychic powers, of course, the dibachaku being more important than the dibasota, but that they're based on, and this is a point that was made by David Kalapahana, the great Sri Lankan scholar philosopher, that these are essentially regarded as extensions of the kind of the natural sense faculty. So they're not regarded as supernormal powers. I mean, they're supernormal in the sense of being better than normal, right? So it's a pure, but it's not regarded as something which is completely exterior to nature. It's a developed and perfected form of those faculties which everybody has naturally. Okay, so this is a difference between when we talked before about the walking on water. It's a difference between that theistic conception of these things as miracles. It's like something which is completely inexplicable outside of the sphere of nature, where God just kind of reaches his hand in and does something, and he does whatever he wants. He's not bounded by any kind of laws of nature. Right? Whereas with the divine powers and so on in Buddhism, it's always regarded as a manifest. It's something that happens within nature. It doesn't bend the rules of nature. It merely applies them in ways that are beyond normal capacity. There's nothing unnatural about them. So the dibba-sota, the basic text is here, and thus with this mind concentrated, purified, cleansed, rid of defilements and malleable, wieldy, steady and attained to imperturbability, he bends and inclines his mind to the divine ear element, dibaya sota dhatuya. So here the word dhatu, again showing how inadequate the English word element is for dhatu. And so with the divine ear element, here dhatu meaning something like faculty or capacity, visuddhaya, which is purified, and atikanta manusikaya, beyond the human. Okay, so the human is manusika, and atikanta is going or gone, and ati is beyond. So literally beyond, gone, the human. Ubosade, one listens to both sounds, both divine and human, both far and near. Okay, and then the simile. Suppose a great man, great king. Suppose a man travelling along a highway were to hear the sound of kettle drums, tabors, horns, cymbals, and tom toms, and would think this is the sound of kettle drums. This is the sound of tabors, which I don't know what's a tabor, T-A-B-O-U-R. I don't know. And a beri sadan, beri kettle drum. Mudinga. Yeah. You know. Horns, actually conch. Horn is a sanka, is a conch. Cymbals and tom-toms, and would think this is all these different sounds. In the same way, a great king, when his mind is thus concentrated, pure and bright, he hears all kinds of sounds, both human and divine, distant and near. This too, great king, is a visible fruit of recluseship, more excellent and sublime than the previous ones. Okay, so it's the ability to clearly distinguish those sounds, which is brought out in the simile there. So the commentary, it is divine here because of its similarity to the divine, for devas have as the divine ear element the sensitivity that is produced by kama consisting in good conduct and is unimpeded by bile, phlegm, blood, etc. So this idea of the sense faculty actually being impeded by the physicality of the human realm, and capable of receiving an object even though far off. And this ear element consisting in knowledge, which is produced by the power of this bhikkhu's energy in development, is similar to that, so it is divine because it's similar to the divine. And it's an ear element in the sense of hearing and so on, and an element in the sense of being soulless. So the idea of dhatu is here explained as meaning not self, which is not really what it means originally, but when it's purified, anything interesting here? Okay, so you can hear sounds that are far off even in another world sphere, as well as those that are near, even the sounds of the creatures living in his own body. Right? So, how do you get it? First you attain the jhana, and then you emerge, then with the consciousness belonging to the preliminary work concentration, that's parikama samadhi, you should advert first to the gross sounds in the distance, normally within range of hearing, the sound in the forest of lions, etc., so all the kind of normal sounds that you tend to hear in the monastery, or in the monastery the sound of a gong, of a drum, the sound of a conch, the sound of the novices chanting, or young bhikkhus reciting with full vigour, and the sound of their ordinary talk, such as, "What, venerable sir? What, friend?" I guess there's so much noise around they can't hear each other. The sound of birds, the sound of wind, the sound of footsteps, the fizzing sound of boiling water, the sound of palm leaves drying in the sun, the sound of ants, and so on. And ants do make a sound you can hear when you hear a lot of them. Beginning in this way with quite gross sounds, he would successively advert to more and more subtle sounds. He would give attention to the sound sign of the sounds in the eastern direction, the western, northern, southern direction, up, below, and all the intermediate directions, both gross and subtle. Now these sounds are evident even to his normal consciousness, but they are especially evident to this parikama samadhi consciousness. And then as he gives attention in this way thinking, now the divine ear element will arise, mind door adverting, arises making one of these sounds its object. This is just this Abhidhamma description of the mental processes. When that ceased, then either that's not necessary to go into those details. So in other words, you do the preliminary work, you do the jhana and so on, and you're ready to do it, and then you pay attention successively to finer and finer sounds, with that resolve that the divine ear element will arise, and then eventually the mind just sort of dropped into that and the divine ear element arises. Herein it is knowledge arisen together with the absorption consciousness that is called the divine ear element, blah blah blah. When consolidating it, you should extend it by delimiting a single finger breadth, thus saying, "I will hear sounds within this area." Okay? And then you do two finger breaths, four finger breaths, and you extend it outwards to the veranda, the building, the monastery, and so on, up to the limit of the world sphere or even more. One has reached direct knowledge in this way. Hears also by means of direct knowledge without re-entering the basic jhana, any sound that has come within the space touched by the basic jhana's object. And hearing in this way, even if there's an uproar with sounds of conches, drums, cymbals, etc., right up to the Brahma world, he can, if he wants to, still define each one thus. This is the sound of conches, this is the sound of drums, and so on. This is the explanation of the divine ear element. So that's clear enough, and it also gives quite a nice method for practicing, eh? If you want to develop that practice. And just to sort of listen to the sounds that are around you, gradually pay more and more attention to the more and more refined sounds. And of course, the interesting thing about that description is that that's exactly what happens in meditation anyway, isn't it? Yeah, if you meditate, especially if you're meditating in the forest, you just naturally become more sensitive to all the sounds around you. You can feel it. It's not... It's very, very real. Your consciousness is becoming purified, and your sense bases are becoming purified, and you hear tiny little sounds which normally you would never pay any attention to. It's a very good way of finding a missing clock. I don't know if you've ever done that, but I've done that a couple of times. You can't find your clock or your watch, you just go and sit in meditation, and after 5 minutes there it is. Uh-huh. Why is that? I don't know. What do you mean, is something falling away?
Because it's always there, and the ability is always there.
Mm-hmm.
As your attention sharpens, something falling away. Inattention, or blockage, or separation.
Uh-huh.
And imagine separation.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's one way of looking at it. And all of these kind of spiritual attainments, generally, you can, it's an attainment of something, but it's also a letting go of something. And so in the jhanas, it's always, something ends, and then something else remains. Yeah, so it's always some kind of blockage. Yeah. I mean, I guess the karmic explanation is that we're, like it says there, that the senses are obstructed by a physical body, and I guess the karmic explanation would be because we're attached to a physical realm, we've become reborn here, and we sort of have to carry these things around because of our attachment to them, but they actually end up just burdening our consciousness. So, you do find these stories of like near-death experiences and things where people do have this very clear vision, right? Yeah, you just have to die. It's always easy. If the jhana path is too hard, then... Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I think it happens all the time.
I think it is not only the physical obstacle, but mental production and self-hinder around it, our ability to see and to view around it. It's an answer. Because to some people, they hear that the inner conversation and the answer, they can't hear. It's okay. And answer, for the seeing the sense, they can't find the role of answer. when the mind not fully concentrated, the breathing and self-nature is obscured. So it's the mental incidence you can sort of play, bigger incident than the physical.
Definitely.
I think that is why we find the dharma always mentioned we have to eliminate all the five hindrances first.
Yeah.
But now, only with that hindrance, we can find it.
Okay, so that's probably enough for today, and next week we can go and look at the remaining of the Chalabhinya, six iron orders. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.